WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. This year marks the National Organization for Women's 25th anniversary. My guest is the new president of NOW, Patricia Ireland. Ireland is a lawyer, but her first career was in a profession famous for its sexism. She was an airline stewardess. In fact, it was her challenges to the airline's discriminatory policies that led her to law school. As NOW's president, she must lead the feminist group through an important election year. What's their political strategy this year?
Well, when we look at the issues, and especially the economic issues this year, which are so critical for all of us, we see really that this 1992 election is a once-in-a-decade opportunity to move more women into positions of power. There have been redistricting of the congressional and state legislative district lines have been changed. We have an estimated 100 open seats in Congress. It's a wonderful opportunity to bring new people in. And there is no debate among us that we need to have far more than just 5% women in Congress. We're certainly looking at alternative ways to put women's resources and political energy. One, for instance, in the Louisiana elections in 1991, where we had the two parties offering us Edwards and Duke. Edwards, who even post the Hill-Thomas confrontation, thought it was a good joke to say that he and David Duke were both wizards under the sheets. An election where the bumper sticker that I think characterized it was "Vote for the crook, it's important," since Edwards had been indicted several times and yet we wanted to defeat Duke. We created an alternative there. We went down there and recruited unprecedented numbers of women's rights candidates to run for their state legislature. And in building a mass campaign for women's rights candidates, we tripled the number of women in the state legislature. We got the first woman elected lieutenant governor. And of course, every one of those people who came out to vote for a feminist candidate voted against David Duke. But I could not, using my most persuasive efforts, coax, cajole, or coerce our people to work for Edwards. If we're going to keep our democracy, if we're going to keep voters involved in the electoral process, we're going to have to create some alternatives, whether that is recruiting new candidates, better candidates for the existing parties, or starting a new party free from the kind of corruption and greed and hypocrisy that most people see in the existing structure. I think that is a direction we have to take.
Do you feel that the Democratic Party has betrayed you?
I don't think there's any question about that. We worked very hard in 1984 and 1986 with the Democrats. 1984 was the only time we'd endorsed a presidential candidate when Mondale and Ferraro ran together. In 86, we worked very, very hard to get the Senate back into the control of the Democrats with the argument that we had to save the Supreme Court. And yet, as each new and more conservative justice went on the court, men who were pledged to support women's rights, Democrats who won with the majority of women's vote and the majority of men voting for their Republican opponent, betrayed us. We look at the Clarence Thomas confirmation as only one in a line of Souter, Kennedy, others who've gone on the court, who mean that the court now, having served for the last 40 years or so as a bastion of protection for individual rights, is now a states' rights court. It's not going to protect individual rights any longer. And I think it was really the last straw for many of us. One of our activists characterized it by saying that the Democrats always come and sweet talk us the night before the election, but then don't respect us in the morning.
Well, do you think the Democrats have taken the women's vote for granted, or the NOW vote for granted, I should say?
I think they've taken the women's vote for granted generally, and they have had often a very good platform, which instead of running on, they have run away from.
I'm just curious, with the presidential election coming up and with a restrictive abortion law about to be challenged in the Supreme Court, a lot of people are saying that because the economy is so bad, abortion isn't going to be the same kind of big campaign issue it might otherwise have been, because everybody's really worried more about their jobs and their health insurance and their bills than they are about anything else. Is abortion going to be number one on your list when you go to vote?
The abortion issue will be a key issue in the 1992 elections, and in many races it will be the key issue. I think that as a feminist organization, when we look at candidates, we look at their stand on civil rights, lesbian, gay rights, women's rights, abortion rights, their economic views, a whole package. We're not a single-issue organization. We are looking for people who will support social and economic justice, a clean environment, demilitarization. We're really looking for candidates who will be leaders to take the country into the 21st century. We would like, before we get to the 21st century, to settle the 19th century question of whether women are going to be full citizens and partners with men in this country, including as part of our economic needs, the ability to control whether and when we have children. You can't plan a career, you can't take part in the social and political and economic life of the country if you can't control your own fertility. It is a real core issue, but it's one of many issues that we're working on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Patricia Ireland. She's the president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Patricia Ireland is my guest, the president of NOW. Anyone who is in the public eye has to make a very difficult decision, which is where to draw the line between what is public and what is private. And you recently said something in the press that has been the subject of a lot of controversy. And my question isn't about your private life. It's about where you've decided to draw that line. And if you have any regrets about if you've been redrawing the line after the statement that you made. And the statement was that you've been married for 25 years and live with your husband in Florida, but you spend a good deal of time in Washington as well, working with NOW, and in Washington you have a woman companion. Your private life is your business, and I'm not here to ask you about that, but I'm just wondering about where you've decided to draw the line now between what is public and what is private.
What I've talked about is my family, the people who are important in my life, and I think that that is appropriate public curiosity about who I am, perhaps. Where I draw the line is with the issue, for instance, of sexuality. I don't think it's anybody's business who I have sex with, if anyone, how often, under what circumstances. I do think that most women and men in this country are much more concerned about their families than mine, much more concerned about what NOW is going to do under my leadership to improve women's economic status, to reduce the violence, to help us get access to health care and preserve abortion rights.
Well, given that your own personal life has been the subject of some controversy, and I know how carefully you're following the presidential campaign, what do you make of the way the press has been handling the question of whether or not Bill Clinton had an affair? And do you think it's relevant? Do you think it's anybody's business? Should we be talking about this kind of thing in our presidential candidates?
Well, I think that the issue goes beyond that. The issue of respect for women, how they treat women on their staffs, who are their advisors? Do they have any women who bring the perspective of women's voices and women's needs to their ears as advisors? Where are they on women's rights issues? Those are so much more relevant than the question of whether someone has had an affair. I think there's also a substantial difference between a person who becomes well known as what's called a womanizer, that is, someone who seems to use women in a way that does show a great insecurity, perhaps on the part of the man, and a certain disrespect for women as well. But I think that the question that has come up around Bill Clinton's campaign is something that we may find as a watershed in moving beyond that the two extremes, the one being the long number of years when the press looked the other way at people in power who had abused their power one way or another, or who had drinking problems, or who were womanizers, and moving into a place where it's put in perspective among a whole lot of other qualifications, a whole lot of other ways to judge their credibility and their honesty and their competence.
Is NOW going to be endorsing any of the candidates in the primary?
I doubt that we will endorse in the presidential election. We've only done that on one occasion, and frankly, our focus is really on moving more women into positions of policymaking and power.
Why not endorse a candidate, though? Why not put your muscle behind the person who you think is going to do best by women?
Well, frankly, we are tired of settling for the lesser of two evils. We find, for instance, Bill Clinton, who has been regarded as the front runner, does not believe in young women's right to abortion. He is willing to restrict young women's right to abortion. We don't find that acceptable. And so we find that Clinton is flawed as a candidate for us. We want to be able to work for people with our whole hearts, with our whole energy, knowing that we're not going to be betrayed. And the Clarence Thomas nomination made it so clear to us the fallacy of counting on someone else to represent us. We need to be there ourselves at those tables where those decisions are made. And so, again, our focus is to move beyond that 5% glass ceiling of women in the Congress, beyond the 2% women in the Senate, ultimately getting women in the pipeline indeed to run for president and win.
The one problem is if you're counting women in politics, that often someone will appoint a woman to a high-level position or a woman candidate will run who's basically anti-feminist. You know, not all women in politics endorse a feminist agenda or, you know, really endorse issues relating to women's rights and women's health care and so on. So how do you deal with that when you know there's a woman who is running for office, but you really disagree with the platform she's running on?
Well, we're looking for the feminization of power. We're looking to move more women into positions of power because we want our issues to move forward. And so if we have a race where a man is supportive of women's rights issues and the woman isn't, we will endorse the man, and we've done that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But subject to the same flaws of any gross generalization, we are looking to move more women into power because we have, on the whole, a greater support for women's rights issues. It's not that there's not some very good men in the Congress. There are. It's not that there aren't some women who will vote against us, because there are. But if I had to start in a dark room just picking out a Congress, I would pick 50-50 and go from there. Women have a different experience in life, whether we like it or not. We're the caregivers of the very young and the very old. I just know intuitively if we had 50% women in Congress instead of 5%, family and medical leave would have become law. Child care would have a priority. Health care would have a higher priority. There are areas that women are responsible for in our families. There are areas where we work. We work as health care workers, social workers, teachers. It's just a different perspective. And that perspective is totally missing right now from public policy setting.
My guest is Patricia Ireland, the president of the National Organization for Women. I read about you, and I never know if what I read about people is true or not, but I read that your mother was the first director of the first Planned Parenthood clinic in the town where you grew up?
Yes, my parents were both involved in Planned Parenthood of Northern Indiana and in founding it and working there. And in fact, I come from a long line of very strong women. My grandmother was one of the first women who ever drove in Chicago. The police in the suburb where they lived used to call my grandfather and say he had to get her off the road. And he would say, why? I thought Beth was a good driver. I taught her to drive myself. And the response was, well, she's a good driver, but all the men who are so startled stare at her and then they rear-end each other. So she should stop driving. It was a time when women were pregnant. It was called their confinement, and they weren't supposed to go outside. Well, we can even remember in our generation women who, when they started to show, lost their jobs as teachers if they were pregnant. My grandmother said, phooey on that, I need exercise, made her own maternity clothes and scandalized the neighborhood by going for a walk every day of her pregnancy. So I come by this naturally, I think.
You are now the head of the National Organization for Women. You are very interested in getting more women into elected office. Do you have any interest yourself in being one of those women?
No, I really think that my role is best out here taking pot shots rather than up there dodging bullets. I do want to encourage us to also be very supportive of the women who are in politics, and I think that I can help do that better from here.
Patricia Ireland, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patricia Ireland is the president of the National Organization for Women.